Welcome to Wild Connection, the podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Jennifer Vertelin. I'm a scientist and author that studies animal behavior. I'm passionate about animals, and I love helping people reconnect with nature to live better lives. This podcast is about you, other animals, and how we're all connected in this wild and crazy thing called life. Welcome back, everyone, to Wild Connection, the podcast. We are still continuing my Voices of Uganda series that is part of my Fulbright, and that's because I'm in Uganda. But back home in the U.S. this week, there is a climate change trial like no other unfolding in the unlikeliest of places, Montana. What does this mean, a climate change trial? Well, in this case, it's 16 young people ranging in age who have sued the state of Montana over their reckless endangerment of their future. The case, Held versus Montana, is grounded in Montana's constitution. Now, the state of Montana tried to get the trial dismissed, but failed. And that's because right there in black and white, the Constitution of Montana guarantees its citizens the right to a clean and healthful environment. More importantly, it's listed first among Montana's inalienable rights, meaning it cannot be taken away. Now, you can check out a link to the Yale article on the show notes for a more detailed look at the case. But what does that have to do with this week's guest? Well, this case ties directly to my guest this week. Born and raised in Kampala, John Kasita Semulima has had an impact well beyond Uganda's borders. Today, Kampala is nothing like it was when he was a child. It still had wildlife then and was more like a village than the bustling, hectic, crowded city it is today. Change is inevitable, and nowhere is that more evident than with the climate. He speaks from a point of view as a Ugandan that grew up there and experienced a deep connection to nature and changes in the environment, and also from the perspective as now an accomplished climate policy advisor with a global point of view. All right, let's get to it. All right, everybody. I am really excited to welcome this next guest. It's continuing the series Voices of Uganda. And his name is John Kasita Semulima. And he is really engaged in climate change and climate policy. And I'm just thrilled to have you. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Jennifer, for having me. I'm very excited to have a go at this podcast and share my opinions about the climate, which is something that has excited me for a long time.
Yeah, and we're coming especially on the heels of COP27 and COP15, the United Nations Biodiversity Conference that was just held in Montreal, Canada. But before we really dive into your work on climate change, I always like for my listeners to learn a little bit about my guests, who they are and how they came to be where they are. So can you share with us a little bit of your background, where you're from, and how you came to focus your efforts on climate policy?
Yeah, sure. So I was born and raised in the East African country of Uganda, the beautiful city of Kampala. And growing up, I was just any other child, having a childhood that was full of play and happy times with children in a neighborhood and all of this. And when we grew up, we were in a setting that was, you would call then, not yet interrupted with the current urbanization that we're seeing everywhere. We grew up in a setting that was in a city, but that gave you lots of access to nature, access to forests, access to swamps. And that's when we grew up. We had lots of interaction as children in the swamps. We ate swamp fruits. We played in the swamps. And that gave me lots of the attachment that I started to have as a child from an early age to nature, because it was something that gave me a living. I played there, I enjoyed my time there. What saddened me though as I grew up, as I was starting to grow up and getting into high school, I went to boarding school, and every time I returned home, the swamp had somehow diminished. Either it had been reclaimed for, I don't know, new settlements, or reclaimed to give way for new agriculture projects or something like that. The place that I had grown up having attachment to was quickly diminishing. I didn't know what this meant for humans as a whole, but I, from a personal point, it meant, you know, I was losing a place that I cherished. And this gave me lots of curiosity to know how man can grow and interact closely with the environment and coexist with it. And that's where my love for nature and environment stained.
Wow. You know, it's funny, like when you were talking, I was thinking about when I grew up in South Florida. I remember whenever it would rain, I would find tadpoles all over the place and I would play with them and, you know, and was fascinated with them. And I don't see that anymore, really anywhere. There's very few places, although I'm in Bwindi and I hear frogs a lot here. So here we still have plenty of frogs when the rains come. But I remember that always, like, that's a memory I have. And so, you know, as you saw this changing and you've now also moved and lived in other places in the world, how do you now connect with nature, right? How does that, what is your way now of feeling connected to the environment and the natural world?
Well, to bridge that a bit, so from that stage of having to miss the nature that I knew, I decided to pursue education that was directed in this line. So from my grad school from my undergrad to the grad school, I focused my studies on environment related studies, and it gave me kind of a launch into the space of environment and climate. And today, of course, the way I interact with nature is not just from a personal stand view, but rather from how could I call this? Maybe a global one. It's no longer about me like when I was a child. It's about the very many other people that really need to survive from the way we use nature around us. So as someone that's in the space that has gotten the knowledge, the understanding, and skill set to advise governments and policymakers, be it in the public or private sector, I use that. That's how I give back to nature. I interact with people, point them to the direction that they should look to for the benefit of very many other people that need to get their living from nature, for the generations that have to come, that will survive on nature that we've taken care of.
Yeah.
And that's how I interact with nature today.
Gosh, you know, it's so interesting that you shared that, because most people answer from, well, I like to go for a run, or I like to go for a walk in the park. And even I have answered that. And yet, since coming here, you know, it was a lifelong dream of mine to study gorillas. But when I was in my 20s, it was all about me. I wanted to be with gorillas. I wanted to understand gorillas. And now I'm here because I realize we can't save nature without helping people, and that we are part of nature. We always think we're separate from it. And so I really appreciate how you have integrated your early experiences and your love of nature, and think now about how you're connecting with it is actually giving back to it by helping other people so that we can find a way forward And that was really powerful. So after getting your undergraduate degree in biology and then a master's degree, you became a Mandela Washington Fellow. And I'd never heard of this program. And so I'm wondering if you could share a little bit about what this program is and what motivated you to pursue that opportunity.
Yeah, the program was initiated by the then President Barack Obama. He had the vision of, well, the way that the U.S. could interact with Africa or kind of develop a relationship with the future leaders of Africa is to develop strong leadership skills of the young generation there. So this is kind of like the idea behind this program. And what the program seeks out is to identify young leaders in the public management space, in the space of civic leadership and business and entrepreneurship as well. So it brings together young Africans from across the continent, normally in a cohort of about 700 or so per year. Puts them in touch with institutions in the US, so mostly universities, that host the fellows and have like a 6-week interaction along the three tracks of learning. So public management, civic leadership, and entrepreneurship. And within that interaction, the young leaders are exposed to not just leadership skills and all, but also they interact with the U.S. society on those particular tracks and have some sort of cultural exchange on that. And, you know, that's what they take back to their country. So it was a really enriching experience for me, most especially because it gave me a chance to interact with like-minded Africans, young Africans that were into doing the kind of things that I also believed in. So there's, if anything, like I can rely I can count on finding a fellow in almost every African country today that has the same motivation and excitement about climate change like I do, and doing things that are not just within our silos as countries, but continent-wide. This is an amazing experience that you don't get so often.
Yeah. Well, and it's interesting because the Fulbright program is similar in the sense that there's a cohort of us, and even if we're in very different countries, doing very different things, there's that commonality and of cultural exchange with where you are. And, you know, I think, and I'm going to be bold and say this to, you know, people in the global north, I think there's a ton of underestimation of the leadership, the creativity, the innovation, and the drive and ambition that people in the global south have. And so did you feel that that opportunity also gave you a voice in communicating with people outside of the African continent?
Very much so, very much so. And I agree with you. There has been a land underestimation of the potential that lies in the global south, the knowledge and, you know, the capabilities of the young and the old in the global south. And I'll call it land because people that get the chance to travel, for instance, you, who's on an exchange in Uganda, quickly unlearn these when they do interact with the people that they find wherever they go. And being in the US, I felt like it was a really good chance to, you know, let the world know what I knew, what I could teach, the opportunity that I had to communicate to people and bring them to an understanding of things they had not really thought about before. What it also did to me was actually to help me and learn. To be honest with you, I was kind of disturbed by the sometimes level of ignorance, like sheer ignorance of that the population had about certain things. And when you have been painted with a picture of, well, there's so much understanding in this place, you can't be, you're not left the same. Me and my peers were always wondering, you know, like, wow, this I didn't really expect. So I think people need to travel a lot. People need to get exposed to other cultures. People need to kind of take off time to break those little silos around themselves and get to see what happens in other spaces and just educate themselves, you know? And that would take us a load, would carry us so far as a global community. It would take us so far.
I agree. Yeah. And I mean, silos around me have been falling rapidly, you know, I mean, and that's part of these kinds of experiences, right, that take you out of your comfort zone as well. And aside from then exposing you to other people, other ideas, other cultures, other ways of doing things, other ways of solving problems that are actually really important and creative, and maybe there's just a lack of resources to expand them or bring them up to a level that works across a larger space. What I've also found in my time here, and I don't know if you found this, you know, when you were, I think you were at UC Davis, was that right?
Yeah. That was UC Davis.
Yeah. So, is that there's actually a lot that's similar between us, more similar than different, right? We all want to be happy. We all want our families to be safe. We all want our kids to do better than we did the generation before. We all, have basic needs, and then we all have our own special talents and creativity and imagination. If you have those needs met, it opens that potential to have the luxury, really, actually, to explore what impact you want to have beyond just your community. On that line, now we kind of get to the heart of what you're doing, right? And how all of these experiences from a child, excuse me, all the way through to the cultural exchange that you had and the opportunity you had as this Mandela Fellow, Mandela Washington Fellow. What exactly do you do now? What does it mean in practice to be a climate policy advisor?
Yeah, well, as a climate policy advisor, I spend my time working with policymakers. And doing exactly what the title says, advising policymakers. I think much of the things that go wrong today are based on either the absence of good policy or the lack of implementation of the same. Many things today might not be able to happen without clear policy in them, without clear political structures, political institutional structures and the like, or even the capacity. And climate change isn't any different. As an advisor today, I speak to governments across ministries on what kind of policy they need to have in place to be able to live or to have their economies survive with the impacts of climate change. How to have the economies abate the negative impacts of climate change. So a concrete example would be, well, you're Uganda, right? You've got a pretty fast growing population. It means you have demand for food that also has pressure on your water resources. But what the fact is that you're having a rain-fed agriculture system today, right? You're relying on that. So you cannot count on being food secure in the future because you might not have rain coming forth due to climate change. What are your plans for that? Is there a chance that you could use underground water actually to do irrigation so that you can have more stable crop production for your growing generations, for your growing populations. So these kind of things mean you are talking to a Ministry of Environment or a Ministry of Agriculture, put together a clear policy on these, put together clear programs. How can we bring in solar-powered irrigation? You know, how can we bring in drought-resistant crop varieties to replace those that are dependent on water? High water quantities. I don't know. It could be the energy sector. If the rivers are going to, if the volumes of the rivers are going to slow down, to cut down, the hydropower might not sustain us that much. Why then don't we point ourselves a bit to the solar energy? Do you have a policy for that? What structures do you need to promote the private sector to, you know, bring in more of the of this technology? Any incentives that you could give? This kind of work. So it's right. from a distance, it sounds like we are climate advisor. What is that? But it's very hands-on. It's speaking to the people that make policy and the people that implement policy. So both the public and the private sector.
Yeah. Well, gosh, that's a tough job. So for anybody who's like, oh, climate advisor, this is hard because I imagine it's, in a perfect world, you could say exactly that. Like, hey, have you considered that as the climate changes, the volume of the rivers might go down, your ability to generate enough power from hydropower is also going to decrease. Have you thought about that? And have you considered shifting to solar power? And so that's all very logical, right? I mean, that who would say, oh gosh, we hadn't, but let's go for it. Let's do it immediately. And yet, from all reports, you know, fossil fuel burning was the highest this year than past year and the past year before that. And so your job is actually not so straightforward, and because you're dealing with politics, right? You're dealing with governments, you're dealing with the private sector. And how do you navigate the different agendas, right? Or all the different agendas that are underneath what seems like a logical, rational, clear path forward to set oneself up for their country, their population, to mitigate future problems?
It's a tough space, Jennifer. I must tell you, it's not easy to navigate that type of space. The thing that we have today, unlike a couple of decades ago, is that you do not have to explain climate change impacts to anyone anymore. We are living with them. The governments can tell that there are floods, there's drought, there's heat waves everywhere, there's all these type of things. And of course, the things that come out of them. Now that your work is in Uganda, I'll stick to Uganda still, for instance. In the recent past, in the last couple of years, there was, due to a heat wave, there was an emergency of the armyworm, which the armyworm was a pest that ravaged corn productions. And corn is such a major crop in Uganda. So the government kind of is now aware of this type of effects, and you don't have to say so much anymore for them to understand what they're dealing with. There has also been studies done to show the economic impacts of climate change, so on the economy. So many countries have this today. So in essence, there's a body of knowledge that has been generated, both open to the open eye and that both scientific, that has been put forward and that helps us to speak to policymakers. The question is, how about the fact that these countries are sometimes thinking, well, we are in this position because someone else did something wrong, so we would like to get out of this, but we need someone's support. And that's where the puzzle becomes a bit more complicated. So the governments in the Global South, much of the time, know that they need to do something. They just think someone needs to support us with this. They put us here. Someone developed their economies. This is what we are reaping. And they, in essence, developed at the cost of others, and they need to pay for this. Now, the difficulty in convincing those who have to pay for this is where the puzzle gets more complicated. So, and to be fair, I think many governments in the global north have put together bilateral programs, have put together development agencies through which money and technical expertise is channeled to help on climate change. And I mean, I work for such an institution, for instance. That's one way. That's one way of saying solutions are being provided. On the other hand, that's just a drop in the ocean of what could happen. When you think about the how much the private sector is still in the global north goes on to pollute. I mean, you just spoke about the high consumption of fossil fuels in the last year. You see, that's insanity when you think. When you're saying, well, we go to the conference of parties, speak about cutting this, everybody's happy, then we go back home and do the total opposite. So, yeah.
And it wasn't Uganda that increased their, you know, that's contributing to this fossil fuel, you know, increase at all. And so a country like Uganda is bearing the brunt of the consequences of the activities of other countries. And then they're also supposed to foot the bill?
Yeah, well, supports to foot the bill. Yeah, maybe not. The thing is, are they supposed to be responsible in one way or another? Yes, they might not have to foot the bill forever, but they might be, for instance, responsible to help these nations put systems in place that will help them to eventually deal with the solutions that they need for themselves. The other thing that they could do is to just cut down their emissions today, you see, so that they don't have to do this any further anyway. So, I mean, we are talking about, the NDCs or the nationally determined contributions that have been discussed at the Conference of Parties. Every country has their own. But even as those climate goals stand, countries are opening up new coal mines. In the global north.
Yeah. No,
that's really sad.
No, it's horrible. And to be clear, I meant that Uganda should not be footing the bill for solving the problems that the global north has, you know, created. So I realize that the way I said that may have sounded like, oh, and is Uganda supposed to foot the bill? Or are these countries supposed to foot the bill? Yes, they are. You brought up the COP, you know, Conference of Parties. So I went to COP26 and, you know, I think that, I mean, my background is in wildlife conservation and behavior, right? Not climate change, not climate policy, even though I'm acutely aware that as the climate's changing, it's impacting species other than humans as well. And, you know, I think that for most of the public, they hear about climate change and they hear warnings, but they don't really understand what's taking place in the background with the governments, with, you know, trying to set policies and with this negotiation is the only way I know how to put it, of countries that have created the problem, supporting and being responsible for the impacts that are being felt by other countries, Uganda, for example. And so I wanted to go because I wanted to better understand, and there was all this hype about COP26. I know we've now had another one, but there was a lot of hype around number 26 that, okay, they hadn't met the Paris Agreement, you know, goals, and this was it. This was the year that they were going to have to, it was do or die, or we were going to surpass this 1.5 degrees Celsius, which I predict we will anyway. And I thought, okay, like, this is the year to go. This is the year to really see what happens here. And I was so dismayed. I left less optimistic than ever because, you know, like you said, there was all of these speeches and we must be, you know, all like countries like, you know, the Netherlands and Sweden and the United States and, you know, Germany and, you know, saying, yes, we have a responsibility and we're going to commit $15 million. That's it. Right? Like that, really? Like that. And they were trying to achieve like 400 and something billion, right? Some massive amount of money. And, you know, they were committing, we commit $5 million. Yay. And then this became the sticking point and the negotiations that year where they dragged on for days and days because there was understandably, you know, real resistance by countries in the global South saying, hey, you need to step up and take responsibility. Having a goal of not cutting forests down, great, fantastic. Reducing emissions, wonderful. Now, our people are starving because we're in drought. What are you going to do? Because you made this problem. And so, I don't know, did you go to COP27?
No, I didn't go to COP27, but I followed it.
Okay, and so
I followed it for actions.
Was this still the same problem that was happening in COP27, or was there some positive shift?
Well, depending on who you ask, I think COPs have been, they've been the same over time. You know, this is the 27th time countries are coming together to talk about climate and do something. Someone would ask what has happened since this 27th year, you know. On a positive note, the Glasgow one, the 26th, did come up with some exciting part of the negotiations, which was a rule book, the Article 6. So part of the Paris Agreement had an Article 6, which was about trading of carbon emission reductions between countries. So I don't know, pollution happens in Germany. Germany does pay Uganda to put up an emission reduction project such that Germany can claim the emission reductions in Uganda. So there was a rule book passed on that. That was a success of Glasgow after a very long time. Mm-hmm. For COP27, the would-be success was that for the first time, countries in the global north agreed that there was a need to put together a loss and damage fund. And the loss and damage fund would be to take care of loss and damage emerging from climate disaster, or at least whatever can be linked to that. And that was a step of taking responsibility, of acknowledging that, you know, all the little countries in the Caribbean that are about to get submerged in the water need help from people who made the glaciers melt or something like that, you know, and that there will be a fund every time there's a typhoon or something like that that can be clearly linked to climate change, a fund from which money can get. So that was a positive thing. The thing is, this fund was created. I mean, this was passed, of course, without any money per se. Like, so here you have a fund that, sorry, we have no money yet. Like, we'll talk about the money back later. So success, on that front, there's an establishment of such a fund, but a lot has to happen and it goes beyond that.
Well, but so, you know, and you mentioned that everybody acknowledges this and everybody says, we must do something. And yet all these new coal mines are starting. And so where is the disconnect? Like, is it purely economical, like where it just doesn't make enough money for certain private sector companies to shift to solar power technology or to shift technologies? I have struggled, just even as a private citizen, never mind an ecologist, to understand why there is an increased reliance on coal. I mean, I understand for certain countries, it may not work, solar and maybe hydropowered, but in many, many parts of the world, we could be doing a lot better. So what is the disconnect in your opinion?
I don't know. I might be wrong, but from what I judge is the thing that we spoke about at the start, the focusing on self and failure to focus on us as humanity, on us as a global community. I think what countries do at the Conference of Parties is to try and look good by saying, yeah, we will do so much, you know? And when they get back home, they become their real selves who are focusing on themselves. And for instance, putting their home economies before the global cause. You see, much of the reason there isn't enough funding going to climate change is because it does not economically benefit the global north.
Yeah,
you see, and that anyone can quote me wrong on this, but like there is evidence of when things directly impact the global north, the speed at which the global north reacts, the type of plugs they will pull to get things back on track is not comparable to what we see in the space of climate change. If the impacts of climate change were felt in the global north as much as they're felt in the global south, the story would be different. It would be very different. And you could talk about the pandemic, for instance.
Yeah.
In the end, everyone reacted differently, but you could say there was some sort of global urgency to try and curb these, because if you all get vaccinated in the US and in Africa not,
right,
the disease is not yet out, it could come back and hit you. That's not the same yet for climate change.
Which is so short-sighted, because, you know, what I think has not happened to the full extent that it will happen, and I could be wrong, is, you know, climate refugee situation. And
it's happening already.
Yeah, I know, but it's not happening at such an intensity that it's, you know, then the question, where will people go, right? People will always go wherever they can to survive. And there are even places in the global north that when they start flooding those coastal areas, you know, projections, you know, in Florida are that like 2/3 of Florida just is not going to exist anymore. I laugh whenever people buy a condo on the beach. It just cracks me up, you know, in a very strange way. I'm like, you paid $5 million to not have a house in 10 or 15 years. And so I think that it's really short-sighted, because we are seeing already, as you rightly pointed out, climate refugees, but not to the extent that it's really impacting the global north population yet. And in the places where it is, like let's say Alaska, where just, you know, the permafrost is melting and entire villages collapse into the sea, those are still marginalized populations that, even though they're in the United States, the American people in general don't care that much about a small, you know, indigenous village on the edge of Alaska falling into the ocean.
That's true. That's what we talked about. Like the level of lack of understanding of the global landscape, you know, people know things that are just up to their nose, for lack of a better word.
Like, I like
when that. When you try to see things beyond yourself is when you start to integrate all those things and how they could actually get back to you at one point. The truth is, there isn't a lack of financial muscle to deal with climate change today. It's just the lack of the will to do it. Many of the companies today that are high emitters are also high profit makers, you see. A substantial levy on them, a substantial tax on them that's specifically going to be transferred to deal with, you know, putting together climate adaptation technologies in place, or I don't know, promoting renewable energies and the like. the amount of tax that could be collected if governments were willing to put that as a decree in their economies is so huge, you can't imagine. You see, some of these companies are already through corporate social responsibility are devoting some of their resources to this, and it's already so sizable. Yeah. Imagine if this was a tax to them. First of all, it would have several impacts. It could mean they would think about alternative technology to cut down their emissions. The other thing is, anyhow, they'll be putting this money in place. Right. And you see, it's this lack of political will to say, well, if I do that, probably the labor unions are going to be against this party, and then we won't have votes next. So it's just thinking about yourself.
Well, and it's interesting, right? Because so there's, boy, I want to pull out a couple of threads, but the most immediate one is you said corporate social responsibility. I think that, you know, as citizens, global citizens, and to the extent that we actually know what is going on, we can make decisions about how we allocate our money and what products we buy, and supporting corporations that have that social responsibility. And so that's the pleasure point for corporations. And then the pain point is the tax on those maybe that don't, and or on all of them to some extent. But I agree with you that I think it's the political landscape where, well, as long as I can stay in power, eventually I'll be able to do something good. And so I have to not push forward on things that will be so controversial or create a lobbying effort, depending on the country that you're from, that will undermine my future, and then I won't be able to do anything good. And that's sort of how you end up contributing in a way that is not positive. Like, you're not actually doing good. In your mind, you're telling yourself, as long as I can stay in this position, eventually I'll do something good. And you end up being the person who just contributed to making things worse.
That's true. that's true. And I think people see things differently, but all had matters to deal with also in history took really strong men and women, to tackle them. They weren't light-minded people. They weren't, you know, think about, now we're talking about the US.
Yeah.
Yeah. You tell someone 200 years ago that you can run an economy not on slavery, on slave labor, like, are you crazy? It can't happen, you know?
Right.
So it took really strong-willed people to say, well, there can actually be alternatives to this. We can end this. Probably there's going to be lots of fire coming from behind me to say, who are you to end this? There's no other way we do things here. But that's the type of leadership we need today. You see, if things like that could change, if things like that could stop, and people think, well, now slavery out, steam engine in, we're going to think about technologies to actually do these plantations. So you can, until you embrace the fact that some things have to be tackled the hard way, you cannot even think about the alternatives to put you forward. If you're worried about your next election, you cannot be thinking about the type of technology that can reverse climate change, climate impacts. You can't preoccupy yourself with that. It looks like it's so beyond what you understand. And I wish many people in such positions could utilize the advantage they have to create that type of history.
I mean, that would be inspiring, wouldn't it, And I think that also comes back to something we were talking about earlier about exposure. In order to really be able to be that kind of leader that makes an impact, you have to have that exposure to different cultures, to different experiences. And I think that one of the things I've always thought about that's motivated me for conservation of other animals beyond just humans is that everything I try to do is to have people relate, be able to relate. If you can relate to a dragonfly in some way,
then that means you can understand it. And when you understand it and you can relate to it, you can appreciate it. And once you can appreciate it, you might be motivated to protect it. But we will never protect anything that we can't relate to. And that goes for each other and for other species. And so the reason why people in the United States might not care about that indigenous village that falls off the face of the earth into the water. Well, it didn't fall off the face of the earth. That's just a saying. It fell into the water. It's still part of the earth. No flat earth. Yeah, no flat earth perspective here on this podcast, please. You could tell them you've lost a culture, a language, a way of life, that these people have lost everything about who they are, their identity, whether it's that village or it's an indigenous population that is now a conservation refugee and has been evicted from their forest. But if they can't relate to that community, that group of people, they can't protect them, and they won't be willing to do things or to make what they might see as a sacrifice, which is not a sacrifice. They won't see the opportunity they have to have an impact, a positive impact on fellow human beings, because they were not even thinking of each other as, well, you're just like me.
That's true. That's true. When you have never known anything beyond yourself, it's or beyond the circumstances in which you live, yeah, you're not going to be compelled to think about other people in other circumstances. And I think that's what when we started this podcast, I was telling you, I bring with me to this global discussion a personal experience with the environment, you see, a personal attached to this, and I know what it means to actually have a season that has no food because the rains didn't show up. Because you come from a country that depends on the rains, and when they don't show up, there's no food. Now, if you've lived your life in a condo somewhere in Boston, never seen a garden anywhere, and you just pick your groceries off the supermarket somewhere, you don't know what global chains they come through. You don't know what people in Chile put through to get you those groceries. Like, it doesn't make sense to you. And you're right. You don't understand why you need to make any sacrifices in lifestyle change, because it doesn't make sense to you, see?
Right.
And I feel like people that have had the chance or that know better need to carry this responsibility and educate, need to carry this responsibility and use whatever platforms they have to cover up for those that have never had these experiences.
Yeah. And what is the solution for people? Like, and I agree with you. So, and that's part of what, you know, I'm trying to do with this podcast is bring those perspectives and, you know, but there's also sort of, we tend to listen and learn what we already believe. That saying of I'm preaching to the choir, you're preaching to the choir. So how do we really connect and have people shift their perspective? I mean, really changing your, right now in the United States, the biggest, everybody's in crisis because of the price of eggs, right? This is their big problem. Like not even, hey, we have eggs. Great, you know, but their crisis is that they're paying so much more for eggs than they think is reasonable. And so the idea that, you know, trying to get those same people to understand, well, but you still have eggs. Yeah. So you still haven't had the experience that when rains don't come, there's no food, because you always have food. You may have to pay more for it, but you still have it. But it's there. And I see people right now, I'm in Uganda and I'm in Bwindi, and tourists come through, about 200,000 people a year come through to see gorillas. And I think very few of them bother to interact with the communities.
That's true. I think what you're talking about is how can we change the climate discourse from, for instance, a predictor of doom saying, well, if we don't do this, you know, glaciers are going to melt. I don't know, we won't have snow anymore and blah, blah, blah. And turn this conversation to people. You see, there's today there's such a thing as attention economy. People are earning from the things that people pay attention to. That's why people are watching reality shows. I mean, they want to know what's happening in people's lives.
Yeah, it's true.
Yeah, exactly. We're so glued on the screen to watch what's happening in people's lives. If on the screens today we could speak about stories of real people that are being impacted by climate change, this could change the perspective of so many people that have never had the chance to, first of all, live this type of experience, let alone experience it or even read about it or learn about it from class. Let these stories go onto the screens, you know? If that's what it takes for people to understand, if they want to watch reality, I wanted to use a certain family, but I don't want to put it in your podcast, but you might know what I mean. Like, yeah. People are spending their time watching this family do their things, go about their life. They could also watch people that are actually going through real hell,
yeah,
with climate. So the moment we start to speak about climate as something that's about people and not glaciers and not, you know, and not droughts and not, so beyond the drought, we're talking about what it's actually causing to unborn children, what it's causing to children that are going without, I don't know, like, let the narrative be about climate change and people.
Yeah.
That means that people don't have to be in Pakistan to experience a flood.
Right.
They don't have to be there. It's fine. They can be seated in their couch somewhere in New York,
mm-hmm,
but they are getting the real story of a family in Pakistan going through this. And perhaps, maybe, just maybe, their perspective about climate change would change. So if we could bring climate change mainstream through telling stories of real impact that's happening in the global South, if anything, it's even a business opportunity, to be honest.
Mm-hmm.
Many people, like I say, people want to see what's happening and monetize that, and people will pay to watch this. Yeah. Who knows?
Yeah, and I'm not sure what that says about us, but that is an excellent point of entry. I mean, I think it also says we're social creatures, right? I mean, human beings are social and we're wired to pay attention to social relationships of others. And we're also, I think, wired to either aspire to something or avoid something, right? And so I don't want to be like you. I do want to be like you. I seem to be the most basic kind of motivations for, I don't know, we use the term rubbernecking at someone else's life, right? It's either watching them from a point of envy or watching them from a point of, ooh, I'm glad that's not me. So, well, I think, well, there you go. We have it. We have an idea to write stories and create story and tell the stories of real people. You know, right now where I am, there's one community where in conversations with some of the local people they have observed that people are going to go hungry because urbanization, which is something that we talked about, people don't have large enough pieces of land or the resources or the water in that particular side is decreasing to grow potatoes. They call them Irish potatoes. I just know them as potatoes. And so there's a lot of corn, as you mentioned, and that the local dish here is posho for corn mixed with millet sometimes. And but that's not enough, and there's not going to be enough food, and you have a lot of land being bought up to build lodges, and you know, people are selling it, and then there's nowhere for them to go, and there's nowhere for them to grow their food, and this is a agricultural based most people grow their own food and rely on that and trade in certain foods grow well in certain parts of Uganda, as you know. And so, you know, you don't find, you know, this food here, you find it grows well in Kabale. And so you have to bring that in from Kabale, and from here, they may not be able to grow corn well over there. So there's an exchange that happens. But I think that most of the global north doesn't actually understand the impacts of food security on communities around the world and how much climate is going to be impacting people. People will go hungry. I just want to touch on something you mentioned, you know, because I don't want to leave it. It was the nationally determined contributions. And that, you said, was really part of the Paris Agreement, which is basically where, and that's something that got also sort of worked out a little bit in COP 26 and 27, where countries that are producing more emissions have a way to offset those. And obviously countries are not reducing their emissions as expected. But you also have the role as a community, a community engagement.
Country engagement specialist.
Yeah, community engagement specialist for these NDCs, as they're called. You know, what does that involve and how is that different from your climate policy work?
So so the NDC or the National Determined Contribution Country Engagement Specialist role is the role that I held previously before I took on the new role here. But I can speak about it. So there is a partnership, a global partnership called the NDC Partnership, and it brings together several countries, as well as multilateral institutions, so the UN institutions, the World Bank, a couple of other international NGOs, and the idea is to bring together several institutions to support countries to be able to achieve their nationally determined contributions. So the idea is every country has their nationally determined contributions, or rather national climate goals, that if there was coordination and support from various parties, each of the countries is better placed to then achieve those goals. It doesn't help us if one country achieves theirs and the others don't, then the global goal of 1.5 is not achieved anyway. So that's the idea behind the NDC partnership. And when I worked there as a country engagement specialist, I was still working with government entities to help them look through those particular goals that they set and to devise plans on how to actually implement them. Because it's one thing to say, I hope to cut down my emissions in the transport sector by, I don't know, 20% by 2030. It's another to kind of put real, you know, activities and say, yeah, to do that, I will need to put a bus rapid transport system and remove all these other little vans. I will need to put, you know. So when I was working as a country engagement specialist, I was advising governments, especially in the Anglophone Africa region, on how they could kind of make their climate goals into granular activities that are implementable, that can be really, money can go to them in real sense and have their goals achieved. So yeah, that's what I did as a country engagement specialist.
Well, I got to tell you, so I have taken up a lot of your time, so I am going to let you go. But I will say that I feel really optimistic knowing that someone like you is out there working on this problem at all of those levels. And as you said in the beginning, you know, you're bringing different perspectives. You're bringing the perspective of having grown up here in Uganda and your connection to nature and the challenges that you've experienced and seen of your own country, and also having had the exposure in other places and working at that interface. And so I'm really grateful for the efforts that you're making and that you're using your love and passion for the environment and for nature to try to reconnect us all globally to each other and to find a way to bring real change to things that need, they will change one way or another. And we will either be, I don't think we'll be ahead of it ever actually, but we'll at least be moving in the direction hopefully that we need to go. So thank you for everything that you're doing and how you're devoting your skills and passion to humanity.
Thank you, Jennifer. Thanks for having me. And thanks to yourself as well for doing such a noble job to spread the word by running this podcast series and trying to get voices out there. I think we need many more of such platforms. And like we said, people need to hear this and people need to get a different perspective from what they've known before. And podcasts like this, of course, serve such a purpose. So well done that. And have a great time in Uganda as well.
Thank you so much.
As John stated so clearly, we are already living with climate change impacts. Canada is on fire again. Drought wreaked havoc on parts of Kenya last year. There's been record flooding at the wrong time of year. And this is just the beginning. Today is Father's Day. And one of my favorite mountain gorillas, Mariah, who's also a father of three right now, has no idea what is happening around him. And when I look at him and I look at all the other mountain gorillas that I have the privilege and honor of studying, I can't help but wonder, what will his world look like in 10 or 20 years? Will his children thrive or barely cling to survival? The thing is, mountain gorillas can't live anywhere else. Windy impenetrable forest, the Virunga volcanoes, Mogahinga, Gorilla National Park, that's it. And there are places on Earth for us humans where we won't be able to live anymore. And that's something to think about. One thing that came up on the podcast was knowing things beyond simply the length of your nose. I really like that saying that John had. That seemed to be the theme, and that if we don't bother to know, understand, relate to, or appreciate other species or other people, we really are doomed. One culture that is struggling to carve a new identity for themselves after being forced to leave their home, the forest of Windi, are the Batwa. Next time, I will introduce you to one of the leaders of the Batwa I've had the pleasure to get to know. If you're enjoying the show, please give it a like and share it with your friends so that they can enjoy it too. You can listen to the podcast on iTunes, Spotify, Google Play, or anywhere else that you get your podcast. You can also check it out on Podbean or listen to it directly on my website, www.jennifervertelin.com. All right, until next time, thanks for listening.